photographs, paintings, editorial cartoons, cover art, memes. Yes, we are awash in visual images that are shaping our perception of the world day in and day out, whether we know it consciously or not. And as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words, and the value, the propaganda value of various images should be apparent to anyone with their head screwed on straight and their eyeballs screwed in straight. But there is a flip side to that. Of course, visual images can be used to propagandize us and to shape our perceptions in ways that are favorable to the oligarchs and would-be tyrants. But there is a flip side to that. That is, people can come along and show and reveal manifest truths through the power of a particularly striking image. And that's what I would like to talk about today on today's edition of Solutions Watch, in the tradition of recent editions of Solutions Watch like Resistance Cinema and Resistance Fiction, which hopefully you'll recall we were talking about back in March of this year. If you don't remember that, please go in the archives to check those editions of Solutions Watch out. But today we're going to be talking about resistance art, which I think doesn't need a whole lot of explanation. Basically, truth art. In fact, you'll recall this is something that I've talked about in the past under that name particularly. Specifically, episode 278 of the Corporate Report podcast was about truth art. And there was also an edition of Solutions Watch on truth art. So I have talked about this before. I have talked to various visual artists before. Let's do it again, because I think this is an incredibly important and oft neglected subject in the conspiracy reality community, and I'd like to give the tip of the hat and point people's eyeballs and attention towards some of the visual artists that are out there helping to free and unlock minds, get people to think about things in a different way. And I have a couple of very interesting conversations lined up for you for that purpose today. You don't want to hear me blabbing on about this subject. No, let's talk to people who are actually involved in the truth art space, creating resistance art, unlocking people's minds. So we're going to start by talking to someone that I hope you know by now. He is Anthony Frieda, and his website is anthonyfrieda.com. And I say I hope you know him because recently I did include one of his Substack editorials in my recommended reading in one of my newsletters, specifically Down and Out in Bohemia, which is a funny, wry, interesting, poignant look at a job that Anthony Frieda took on of helping to sort a van line of packages that were being delivered to the Tony Summer homes of the oligarch establishment jet set on Long Island's East End, and getting the view from the workers' perspective there. And there's some very interesting piece of art that accompanies that piece. So hopefully you saw that before, but if not, here's your chance to acquaint yourself with Anthony Frieda and his work. As I say, his website is anthonyfrieda.com, where you can see his portfolio of work. You can check out his podcast, which he's doing. You can read about news and get in contact with him. There's a lot to explore there, but let's bring him on the program. Anthony Frieda, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, James.
All right. Since this is your first time on the Corbett Report, why don't we introduce yourself and your work for the audience? As I say, obviously people can go to anthonyfrieda.com for more information about your work and your background, but let's get it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Who are you? Where did you come from? Why and how did you get into visual art in the first place?
Well, started as a child, right? It was just something that I was always had an affinity for, and I like to draw, and I got a lot of praise for it as a kid, you know, and I like to please people. And I also just figured I'd go with my strengths because, you know, life is hard enough, and it was something I had a natural talent for. So, you know, my mom would hang the picture on the refrigerator, and I would get love from my mommy. So it was like I associated art my whole life with love and trying to please people, but also please myself, and also as a way to really lean into this God-given gift that I had and try to use it for the best purposes, which I didn't always do, but I've come to atone for my sins, my artistic sins, and I really try to work now to just to use everything I've learned in my 40-year career as a way to spread messages of human liberty and dignity and peace and transparency and truth and justice and the American way. So this is what I do.
That's a tall order. But as you mentioned, a 4-decade career, obviously that has spanned a large section of time. And obviously there's been a trajectory to that career. And you've been featured in Time and The New Yorker and very mainstream publications. But you've also done some bold and challenging truth art. And I imagine there's probably a story in there about going from very commercial interests into more truth-related interests and how that might have affected your commercial career. Tell us about that trajectory.
Yeah, so as a young man, I got out of art school. I went to Pratt in Brooklyn, and I tried to make it as a fine artist, an editorial artist, and I just didn't have the depth or the wisdom or even the talent at that time. So I got this job in advertising, and because I needed a job, and that time in the 80s, advertising art was very lucrative place to be, and I worked for a studio for a year, and then I started my own studio, and I worked for all the Fortune 500 companies, and I was making a lot of money. I was successful. I bought a condo in New York City, and I thought I was on top of the world. I was a young man. I was pretty naive, and I was just really thinking about how profitable it was and that I was a success, and I wasn't really, and I got to draw pictures, right? So it seemed like a good deal. And then I started working on this campaign in the 80s called the Joe Camel campaign, which was it was banned by the FTC because they said that we were using cartoons to sell cigarettes to children. So I had a sort of come to Jesus moment, and I said, wow, I never really thought about it in moral terms, what I'm doing. I mean, I was working for liquor companies and cigarette companies and drug companies. And I never thought of the moral context of what I was doing. I was just drawing pictures and getting paid. I thought about it very simplistically as a business transaction. And then that campaign, something, I had a dark night of the soul. And I said, I got to get out of advertising, because I saw all the Bernaysian techniques they use for mass psychological persuasion. And I was turned off by that. And I said, I'm going to work for the good guys, right? I went to work for the New York Times and for Wall Street Journal. And I thought in my naive 20s that, the legacy media were actually trying to speak truth to power. I was pretty naive at the time, James, but I've come a long way. So I'm working for the New York Times. I'm on the op-ed page. I'm working for Rolling Stone and New Yorker and Time Magazine, like I said. And it was right at the onset of the Iraq War that I got this piece that was penned by then Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. And she was outlining this, all the false pretexts for the invasion of Iraq. And then I said to myself, wow, you went from selling cigarettes to kids to selling war to everyone. You somehow made a worse moral turn. And at that same time, around that same time, I got this job for the Village Voice, and it was this piece called Fakes on a Plane, and it was about all these conspiracy theory documentaries that were questioning the 9/11 narrative. Now, I lived in downtown Manhattan when 9/11 happened, so I bought into the whole thing. Like, I wouldn't get bin Laden, because I waded through the dust. I saw people falling from the buildings. I smelled the acrid air of death for months. I had to go through checkpoints to get into my building, and I watched all three towers fall with my own eyes that night. So I was viscerally, emotionally invested in it, and I succumbed to the propaganda at first. Then I get this assignment, and I went in thinking, I'm going to make fun of these guys. They're all crazy tinfoil hat wearing lunatics, right? Of course, bin Laden did it, there was Al-Qaeda, the whole thing, right? And I'm watching these documentaries. It was Loose Change and a few others. And I'm like, oh my God, like my whole world, just everything I ever thought about anything just collapsed. So like the advertising disillusionment and then the editorial disenchantment with them. This was the final straw. I said, everything is bull and we're being lied to on a massive scale about incredibly serious things. And that I realized that the deep state and the mainstream media are joined to the hip, Operation Mockingbird. And I started doing this deep dive into it. And at that time, it was a seminal start of the news aggregator sites like InfoWars and other sites. And there was all these people in the health freedom movement and they all needed artwork, right? They needed book covers and they needed posters for the documentaries. They needed content for the websites. So I sort of reached out to them. I started working for InfoWars. I reached out to Alex. I worked for him for 10 years. And then I TransJournal, Joe Talente, I worked for him for 10 years. And then I met all these amazing people that were really truth seekers and they were putting themselves and their career and their reputations on the line at great personal cost to try to at least uncover what is really happening and what is the truth and trying to use the internet, which at that time seemed like it was going to be this, you know, our savior. It was like, it was this place where we could have a free exchange of ideas and we could expose all the lies of the mainstream press and the government malfeasance and corporate malfeasance. And it was very exciting in those early heady days of it. Of course, the boot came down not too long after that, but there was sort of, I'm sure you remember, you were a big part of it. I mean, I saw your 9/11 video and it just blew me away. 20 years ago when you started, you know, around the same time I started getting into this online activism. And so I found my home, James, and now I can sleep at night. I'm not hurting children or starting wars, and I feel better about myself.
It does feel good to align your personal beliefs with your passion, with your creativity, with your work. And when all of those line up, that's a blessing, isn't it? But let's not gloss over that interesting nugget that you just dropped there. So you saw WTC7 be demolished as well.
I saw it from my rooftop and it looked like a controlled demolition. And I say at the time, it didn't make sense, but it didn't quite register. Like they said it was a fire and I watched it just perfectly fall into its footprint. I watched all three buildings fall perfectly into their footprints. And it's something didn't make sense about that. Like this building didn't even get hit by a plane and it perfectly collapsed into its footprint. And something was unsettling about it, but I didn't know enough to know that there's no possible way this could have happened through this terrorist thing that happened that morning. I mean, that morning, I thought my building got hit by a truck when the first plane hit. I looked out the window and I didn't see a truck, but I saw smoke coming out of the North Tower. And obviously I knew something was very wrong. But I also witnessed on my street, they were lining up almost like just a few hours after it happened, hundreds of military looking dump trucks, hundreds of them. They were all orchestrated and lined up down my street. And they were there to clean up the crime scene before it was investigated. And I thought that was odd too, but I witnessed that with my own eyes. So I saw a lot of odd things that day, but like I said, I wasn't smart enough and I was emotionally a wreck. And it didn't really all click until later on I could put all the pieces of the puzzle together.
So how far away were you and did you hear anything with those demolitions?
Oh, I could hear it, yeah. I was less
any explosion sounds?
I don't remember. I remember seeing, I saw the explosion. I saw the plane hit. I didn't see the plane, but I saw the explosion in the second tower. I was looking right at it when it exploded. And, it looked like a movie. I mean, it looked like, just like you see in a movie. It was unbelievable. It was like cinematic and it was shocking. I was in such a state of sort of emotional, I was in almost a hypnotic state. It was so surreal to watch these towers fall. And then I was looking south and then I looked north and I had this almost a hallucination of all the other towers in New York, like the Empire State Building falling. I figured they were all going to start falling now because it was so, It was so unnerving to watch something that this was a square acre of concrete and steel that was designed to have a plane impact it and not have this happen. And it happened right before my eyes.
So let's talk about your 9/11 inspired art then. How has 9/11 informed your visual art?
Well, I did that piece for the Village Voice and I watched all those movies and I had some righteous anger about it because I felt it was personal. You did this to my neighborhood. And I contacted the museum and I said, you need to have some 9/11 truth art in this, in your collection. If you say you're collecting this a representative of, you know, a visual and ephemera from 9/11 and across the spectrum of different ways of looking at it. So I petitioned them and to their credit, they met me in the museum and they accepted my piece. They interviewed me for like an hour and I have a video of it. They said we couldn't video it, but my friend who's a filmmaker came with me and he just put the camera on the table and he videotaped the whole thing. It was beautiful because they said, no cameras are less. I said, okay. So he just put it down, but he didn't tell them he kept it on the whole time. And then after we uploaded it to YouTube, they threatened to sue us, but we just, you know, we called their bluff and they never did sue us. But anyway, it was supposedly one of the only 9/11 pieces in the museum that questions the official narrative. So I wanted that piece in there just as a documentation of a different way of looking at this thing.
Let's talk about some of your other truth-related art, and one that obviously sticks out because of recent developments is your work with C.J. Hopkins, who you've referred to as the legendary thought criminal. I will direct people to a Substack that you wrote about this work a couple of years ago, The War on C.J. Hopkins. But as you can see there, yes, you were involved in the cover design of one of his books that turned out to be highly controversial, or at least interested in by the authorities. So tell us about that work and how you came to start working with C.J. Hopkins.
Yeah, so CJ contacted me and he had this, it was his concept. You know, he wanted to do a take on the rise and fall of the Third Reich. But he's an expat, he's in Germany and, you know, he grew up in America, but he moved there. You know, ironically, he moved there when he saw after 9/11 that they were clamping down on civil rights and civil liberties. He didn't want to live in a fascist state. So he moved to a place and then they wound up arresting him. All he did was post this cover. So this was after COVID. I had a feeling like they're going to come after him. So I tried to keep it as subtle as possible. You could see there's a barely recognizable swastika underneath the COVID mask. And the German authorities and the Berlin prosecutor didn't like that, James. They had a real problem with it. And they charged him with disseminating Nazi propaganda. The first time they charged him, they've charged him subsequently. They went to his house, they seized his computers, they interrogated him and his wife, and he went to trial. And the original trial, in Germany, it's not like here where they have a double jeopardy. Like they can charge you, keep charging you, and they come up with new crimes. And they're still torturing him. This is going on for years. They're trying to get him in prison. But the thing is that he's protected by the law. The satire laws in Germany clearly protect him. You can look at the covers of Der Stern and other, Der Spiegel. They use Nazi iconography all the time. You know, it's fine if you want to, they have a literal cover where Trump dressed as a Nazi with a swastika on his arm. That's fine. They didn't get in any trouble. This is a political persecution of C.J. Hopkins for his take on the COVID crimes and the lies. And he's still being persecuted. He's still trying to keep from going to prison. So it's an ongoing legal battle. You can read the details. CJ has written extensively about it. But I mean, it's taking quite a toll on this man. And I feel guilty because I'm a conspirator and I've been okay. They haven't come to arrest me yet. So it's just tragic. But CJ's on the front lines. He's a true hero and martyr for free speech because he's paid a dear price for it.
It's absolutely ridiculous and disgusting. It shouldn't be surprising, I suppose, at this point, but it's just so blatant, the double standard. And you show that, for example, in your article with the different covers that are totally fine in Germany, except this particular cover. Oh, my God, that's totally verboten. Yeah. Interesting. But obviously just indicative of the way that truth art in general is treated. So I would imagine it's probably more lucrative to be doing op-eds, cartoons and things for New York Times and New Yorker and places like that than it is to be a freelance truth artist. But tell us about tell us about that aspect of your career.
Yeah, you might say that I took a little pay cut. I became an outlier. I used to be like part of the cool club. Like I was the Society of Illustrators. They loved me and I was working for all the top guys. And I was, you know, considered one of the prominent editorial illustrators in the country, winning awards. And then they started seeing some of my thought crimes. And it was when Hillary first ran. That was the real one they had a problem with, because I wasn't a fan of old Hill. And they didn't like that. You know, I was supposed to create art where Hillary is the saint, and I was painting her as a demon. So they didn't like that very much at all. And so I was outcast. I became an outlier. They all stopped calling. They all stopped inviting me to parties. And, you know, I was persona non grata. And I mean, I knew that, but I couldn't do it, James. I can't do something that's against, I know what they want me to draw. I know what they want me to paint. I could be on the cover of New Yorker every week if I wanted to. I know exactly. Talk about, you know, the Nazi stuff. Like, every illustrator I know has done their painting of Trump as Hitler. You know, it's so boring. It's so predictable. It's like, I mean, you can't come up with something better than that. And every time they do it, they all congratulate each other. You're so brilliant, so fearless. It's like, no, but that's not brilliant, fearless. You know, that's, you know, it's like Godwin's law, right? Once you compare somebody to Hitler, it's like, you lose because he's not Hitler. So this is a cover I did for CJ. I try to take a different take. I made, you know, I think it's more interesting to show him as a punk. This is one I did. They didn't like this one either. This was Cindy Sheehan. This is Obama with a Pentagon slave collar on. They didn't like that one either, Jane. This book got banned too. A lot of my books have been banned. But they said I'm a racist. By the way, the foreword is by Larry Pinkney, who was one of the founders of the Black Panthers. And I talked to him. I said, do you think this cover is racist? He says, absolutely not. So if the founder of the Black Panthers says it's not racist, that's good enough for me.
Well, Anthony, you have obviously managed to persist and even to thrive, I dare say, in the decades that you've been taking this mantle. And so I wonder if you have any words of wisdom or advice for any young up and coming would-be visual artists who are looking to apply their skills towards this fight for truth and justice. What would you say to people in that situation?
I would say to any creative, self-censorship is death. To an artist, you got to be brave and strong and speak the truth. Speak your truth. Create something that you think is cool, you think is good. Don't worry about what anybody else thinks. Don't worry about how many likes it gets. Create something that's true and from your heart and an honest expression of you and your beliefs, and find something you care about and really care about it. And then you have God on your side. Then you're channeling your birthright and your purpose into something productive and meaningful. And be bold, and mighty forces will come to you. If you're meek and you're cowardly and you do things because you think it's going to be popular, you're never going to make it in any endeavor, I believe. You know, that's a sellout. That's a quisling, whatever you want to call it. Like, don't be that guy, right? Look in the mirror and do something that you know is true and you know is good, and you will be rewarded.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, there he goes, Anthony Frieda. AnthonyFrieda.com if you want to learn more about Anthony Frieda's work and how you can follow that work. It's all there on the website, and the links to all of his various resources are there. So let us keep things rolling with not more James Corbett, but with more from a real, actual, visual, practicing visual artist. And in this case, we're going to talk to Jordan Henderson at jordanhendersonfineart.com. Once again, if you want to go there to find out more about Jordan Henderson's work, you can do so, and I suggest you do, where you can not only see his artwork, his socio-political artwork, as well as his paintings and charcoal drawings, but you can also, of course, order prints of those drawings. You can also read his essays and his newsletter and find out more about him in the About tab. It's all there, so let's bring him on the program. Jordan Henderson, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
All right. Well, people in my audience should already know about your work. And I say that advisedly because they will know my previous guest, John Manley, who I've talked to a couple of times now and talked about resistance fiction. And of course, we talked about Powerless in the Film Literature New World Order series. But people who have read John Manley's book, Much Ado About Corona, will know this cover image, which I understand was painted by yourself. And let's talk a little bit about that and how John Manley came to find out about you and your work, specifically around a COVID era painting that you put together in the early stages of the scamdemic, Sanity, Her Son, and the Credulous, which got some traction in the alt media. It was posted up, for example, at Off Guardian. So I'm sure people have probably seen that one kicking around. But let's talk about that work and when and how you were inspired to do that.
Yes. Yeah, so that was the first painting that I would put in the socio-political category of artwork that I'd done. And I'd never intended on doing any, actually. I don't know why it hadn't really occurred to me that I wasn't going to do that. But it was during COVID. It had started. I was already quite skeptical of it. I'd been following like John Rappaport, who was, you know, tearing it apart from the very beginning. And so Washington State was announcing way ahead of time that they were going to put in place the mask mandates, and that on this date, you know, apparently it's fine now, but on this date, this is all going to go into effect. And so on that particular day, I thought, okay, well, I'll just go shopping without a mask. So I went to the neighboring town and went shopping without a mask. And I was shocked that almost everyone had like a movie, like zombies. They just all switched to wearing masks and doing exactly what they were told. But every now and then you would see someone who didn't have a mask on it, and it was just an interesting feeling. It was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Like, there's somebody who evidently is seeing through this and maybe thinking through things. So it was a positive feeling, and I thought, I want to capture that in a painting. And so I thought about it a while, and that's the painting idea I came up with. One of the main devices I used in that was just putting everyone else in kind of a grayscale. Like, I grayed them all out with just ivory black, just put it in all the other pigments to gray them out, and then put the people not in the masks, put them in full color. And I felt like that kind of captured some of the feeling of what I saw on that day. And then that painting, by the time I was done with it, even though I hadn't intended on doing those sort of paintings, the ideas just started to flood in. And then from that point, I started doing several paintings of this sort per year and exploring topics I hadn't thought I would before, and just realizing that art, which was something I was already quite into, was a great medium for pushing into controversial social and political topics too.
Yeah. Absolutely. And actually, that is surprising to hear that that was your first piece of socio-political art, because I do note on your website, you have your artwork broken down: paintings, landscapes, animals, people, charcoal drawings, genre works, charcoal drawings, character studies, and social and political art. And clearly, you obviously have our artistic background, artistic talent. You've done a lot of really stellar work there. But I would have assumed that this would have been woven in throughout your entire artistic journey. But no, it's interesting to find that that's actually a relatively recent phenomenon. Tell us a little bit about your artistic background.
Yes. Okay. So my father is Steve Henderson, and he's an artist and been practicing for a long time. When I was growing up, he primarily did medical illustrations, actually. And I was always impressed by his artwork, but because he was my dad, I just kind of took it for granted. Like, okay, that, cool, of course he does that. And then eventually I started to see it in context and how talented he was. And I thought, well, that would be kind of cool to follow that and learn that. And I had a great opportunity too, so I started pursuing it a little at a time. And then there were also other things about art that started to draw me towards it. Like, one is that I feel like the reality we experience is a confluence of a couple different principles coming into play at once, right? Like, so some of those would be principles of like physical matter, and we have all sorts of ways of studying physical matter. So we have sciences and mathematics and engineering, and we use that to study physical matter. But I also feel there are other aspects, like psychological and spiritual aspects, and that we do have other tools for trying to explore or study or figure that out. And I would see the arts especially as being that, right? Like painting, poetry, music, for pushing into this kind of mysterious realm. And it especially feels like a threshold, right? That you're in the physical world, but you know there's a little something more, and you're trying to push into it just a little. And that effect is created even in a painting, right? Like a painting can be almost a threshold or a liminal space because you can look at it and it's a two-dimensional surface and it has pigment on it. And that pigment, right? Like if it's ivory black, that's literally like crushed ground animal bones. And titanium white is titanium and zinc, and it's suspended in walnut oil. So it's just this physical flat surface, and you can see it's a physical flat surface. And but then you can push into it a little and see something almost through someone else's mind, right? Like looking through their eyes at what they were seeing, or letting it speak to you a little. So I felt like it was at an interesting threshold of something mysterious that I wanted to explore. And that's what really sucked me into it.
It's interesting. Yes, of course. All paintings are representational by nature. The treachery of images, as Magritte would put it, is to see Nippon pipe and peep, right? It's not a pipe. No, it's a painting of a pipe. So what is that? And what is it gesturing towards? And what does that make us experience and think? Yeah, of course, this is highly philosophical, but obviously an important part of the representational nature of putting these ideas into art. So talk then about the transition from more, what shall we say, grounded in reality, whatever, I don't know how to say it, but more representational art to more symbolic art, trying to get people to think about and see the socio-political world from a different perspective through art. I assume that takes a different type of approach, or is it? Do you see a continuity with your other work?
I do see a continuity. A couple things that came together that converged on this. One was I became interested in symbols, specifically symbols, right? So like Mark Passio has a whole series on symbols that I found quite interesting. You interviewed Freeman Fly, and that was a really interesting interview of just how he was dealing with symbols. And from that, I also started to rethink even just art, of non-symbolic art, how symbolic it really is, right? So like each main era of art reflects the age it's from, right? So when oil painting really starts taking off and it starts looking really good and people can express themselves and do justice to the outer world when they're portraying it in a painting, it starts out as all like religious art and painting nobles and so forth, because that was the obsession at the time, or at least of those who could fund the artwork. And then you start seeing paintings of just a pure landscape, of people looking at that as something beautiful. Or in the late 19th century, they really started painting just ordinary people and peasants. And now that might be derided as like sentimental, but I see that as a really positive social development. And then you get into early 20th century art, and you'll get like Marcel Duchamp's found pieces, where he'd just take like a bicycle tire, or most famously a urinal, and say, this is art because I say so. And I feel like that reflects the materialism of the age, of not really seeing anything deeper, so it's all almost equally meaningless. So that made me start thinking that it was all symbolic anyways. And again, combined with what I'd been learning a little from someone like Freeman Fly or Mark Passio about symbolism, of how they would work with it, of how they would see it, some of it is almost being a little more basic than you would think, even like a geometric shape, that it could represent order or something because of how even it was, or like a circle is a perfect shape. So I just started working at multiple levels there. And then when I got into the artwork, it just opened up a new world. So it's been fun exploring it and hopefully taking my audience along with me a little bit.
Excellent. Well, let's get into some specific examples. And I know, obviously, it is just about the time for the big 250th birthday celebration extravaganza there in the United States of the wonderful birth of the American nation, or is that empire? And I know you have some things to say about that through your art. Let's talk about some of the pieces that you have and are working on to coincide with this glorious celebration.
Yes. So I started thinking about this a couple years ago, of some paintings to do for this time, actually. And some of them I did like a couple years ago, and they've just been sitting in my studio. And then some of them I've been doing more recently. One of them, An Empire Is Born. The inspiration for that was that with us Americans, I feel like we have a bit of a Stockholm syndrome relationship to our government. And there's a couple different views of what and who we are that we're given. And so on the left, you basically get like a shame-based narrative of just how awful we are, and we have so many sins to atone for and so forth. And then on the right, you get this idea that to some extent, we've already figured it out, and this idea that we have a government by the people, for the people, and so forth, which would be a great idea if we did. But I think we can all kind of see that we don't, because we know that, like politicians, that they always lie, and they lie because if they told us what they were going to do, we wouldn't vote for them. So the idea that they actually represent us is kind of preposterous. But I do appreciate that Americans are looking for something. They're looking for something to represent who they are, what they are. They're trying to find some roots. And so in a painting like An Empire Is Born, I was trying to find something to represent what people think is America, which would be the stars and stripes, right? Like that's the classic. And then thinking, okay, I need something else to represent what Americans actually are, like some positive elements that we have there. And so I settled on the Gadsden flag because I thought, okay, it's kind of folksy. I like that. In some ways, it's a little, there's some cringy aspects to it. Like it has writing on it. That's always irritated me. You don't have to put the writing on there because the snake already symbolizes don't tread on me just by what a rattlesnake is. But I thought, okay, that's an interesting counter to the main flag, you know, to the government's flag, the stars and stripes. Okay, this could be more of the people, their flag. And then this is what I'm starting the series of paintings with. I might call it something like Fantasia Americana or something like that. And then I'm going to end it with something a little more positive, a painting I'm working on right now. And so I'll bring the Gadsden flag back in and kind of a resurrected form of that snake. And I also like that it's a snake too, as far as the symbolism of a Gadsden flag, because a snake, you know, a rattlesnake is very American, right? Only we have them, you know, in the Americas. But also snakes are universal and they symbolize things such as wisdom, right? So even something like the Garden of Eden story we're all familiar with. And depending on how you look at it, that you could look at that as something what of a hero, as, you know, a saying, you know, instead of trusting the authority figure, why don't you figure this out for yourself, you know, actually learn good and evil. So the snake in particular, I recognize as having a lot of potential, and I just wanted to play with that a little and maybe elevate it as a more positive symbol for Americans.
I can imagine the religious conversation that's going to be taking place in the comments just based on that alone. But anyway, sure. How about the sacred cow?
That one was more inspired by especially the Pledge of Allegiance, which is something I've always found somewhat peculiar, right? Because it's like what people think that's going to do for them, right? Because what you want to do is the right thing, right? So if your government were to tell you to do the right thing, well, hopefully you'd be doing that anyways. And if they were to tell you something you shouldn't do, hopefully you wouldn't do that. So it felt, the Pledge of Allegiance is something I've always seen and experienced since childhood, including in like church environments, right? You would think that a church environment, because that's an environment I grew up in, you would think they would not be pledging their allegiance to something like the flag of a secular government. That seems very odd, but they do. And it would be part of like youth programs and so forth. And so it always had a very religious feeling to it. And I wanted to just capture a little bit of that religious feeling. So I was just looking for imagery and symbolism that would allow me to do that. Now, when I painted that, something interesting about working with paintings to communicate is that because you're using images of things that can mean multiple things, right? Like something like a cow can mean a lot of things, and it's used in a lot of different mythologies and so forth, that the painting can serve as a catalyst to get people thinking. And then someone might see something in it. They might see a meaning to it that's deeper than what you even intended. And I think that's really fun. So a friend of mine came into the studio and they saw it actually as the stock market bull
That's a great
interpretation too.
Yeah. Again, these, yes, because the symbology is resonant of so many different things and it ties into these deeper cultural associations and historical associations, and even in some cases, maybe biological associations that we have, a fear response to snakes or things like that. It taps into such base responses that it can be resonant and implicate many different things at the same time. But the image that I must confess I think is nearest and dearest to my heart because of my political proclivities is People's Choice. Tell us about that painting.
I painted that in the run-up to the last election, but I didn't intend it to represent just that election. I thought that this could actually speak to basically any election that we have. And that you're voting someone in and they give you promises, but they have no obligation to actually fulfill any of the promises that they gave you, which is really unique because there's not many other areas like that, right? Like if you were to purchase a service from a company or buy a product And if they were to be like, well, we told you it was this, but we're actually sending you something totally different, that would generally be considered unacceptable. But in politics, we've just all come to accept it, that you vote for someone and they might do something completely different and you don't really know what you're getting, right? Like, I mean, you might know what each party is going to bring to some degree if you've put a ton of research into it and trying to figure out who's backing them and what actually does this contain. But that even then, you really can't be sure what sort of backroom deals were going on or anything. So it is like just choosing between two Trojan horses and not really knowing what either contains. And this one looks a little better. And I thought it would help illustrate also, or at least just make people realize again, how preposterous it is to think that this is supposedly a government by the people, for the people, of how is that us? How is that representing us? How are we governing by not even knowing what's contained in the party that we're bringing into office next?
And again, multiply resonant on so many levels. Obviously, the concept of the Trojan horse, this gift, this wonderful thing, it's for you. And of course, it's harboring your actual enemy. There's such a profound statement that's being conveyed there with absolute, well, I won't say zero words. I guess the word vote is written on the voting box, but other than that, as I say, I hope people will explore your website, jordanhendersonfineart.com, and your portfolio. You have a lot of different paintings that I think are worth people's time and attention. But let's talk about the mundane, or, you know, everyday aspect of this, commercial viability. Are you making a living doing this type of art? If so, how? If not, how do you make a living? And what does that say about the world that we're living in? And how has your turn to socio-political art affected your either commercial viability or even social viability in art circles that you may or may not move in?
From the standpoint of making a living, that's hard to do with art at all, actually, with painting. Obviously, some people do. Especially today, it's quite difficult. A lot of artists talk about who have been doing this much longer, how especially after the 2008 financial crisis, they had a hard time getting back to where they were. So I've never made a living off of it. I've always thought that would be nice. That would be really cool to do. And at first, I stressed myself out more trying to make that happen. And now I've gotten a little more relaxed about it and mostly just focus on trying to make sure I have enough time to keep pursuing it. I think something will happen eventually, but I feel like it's more of a marathon than a sprint. And in the meantime, I've worked a whole series of different jobs, always focusing on keeping them either seasonal or part-time so that I have time to keep pursuing art. So that's included firefighting, teaching. I've done restaurant work. I've done quite a few different types of work, usually several years at a time. And quite a bit of it's been enjoyable. And I don't feel like it's like hurt what I'm doing artistically. Maybe it even helps as far as making me a little more focused and using my time as best I can. Otherwise, I think I'd have a tendency to, I don't know, maybe not stay on track as well.
Well, keeping one foot in the so-called real world is probably conducive to being able to produce art that's reflective of that world, so to speak.
Yeah.
But what about the social aspects of this? I mean, I can imagine that there are many people in art communities who are not amenable to these types of socio-political truths.
Yeah, that's for sure. So I have shown some of this in person, which has been great. And that was mostly because a gallery in Pueblo, Colorado called Blowback Gallery, during COVID, they started doing a truth show. And I think Jeff Medine, who runs the gallery, did that for like 4 years. So I've had pieces at every one of those. And again, that was in the middle of COVID, including some of my more critical or controversial ones. And he was willing to put those up. So that was really cool being able to get those in front of an audience. The main way, though, most people will have experienced the artwork will have been online through places like Off Guardian or Winter Oak. And so the art has basically served a role that I would see as comparable to editorial illustrations in magazines or newspapers of the past. And I'm fine with it in that role, too. And even in the past, the golden age of illustration, a lot of those artists, mostly people saw their work in like a printed form, you know, not the original. That was something what of a rarity. Now, like you were alluding to earlier, this art definitely isn't welcome within like the artsy world, but I don't think my art would have been anyways. I don't think I was ever going to make any headway there. So there was really nothing lost. And as far as the social aspect, as far as, let's say, people like cancel culture or something, there's a meme that perhaps you've seen, and it's a popular meme template, and it uses a scene from Jurassic Park in which someone's transferring someone to someone else, and the guy's like, oh my God, you can't mention that. You know, other people are going to hear that. And the guy's like, wait, nobody cares. And, you know, he speaks to the whole crowd and says, see, no one cares, right? And I feel like with cancel culture, that's something that people get into, is they psych themselves out and they think, oh, if I speak my mind, if I speak up for what I think is true and I don't use a pseudonym or whatever, I'm just going to get vilified and canceled. And I think what's happening there is almost a form of survivorship bias. Like, you know how people will do something and say, it was fine for me? And it's like, well, of course, only the people who survived are the ones who are going to be here to say it's fine for them. And with cancel culture, the only people we hear about are those who actually did get canceled. But I think in general, really no one cares. And you can speak your mind and it'll be fine.
Well, it's what I'm trying, and other people out there are doing it as well. And, you know, I'm still alive at any rate. Yeah, it seems to be working. Let's talk about something that is an important part, an important issue in the, I guess, in the world generally, but certainly in art circles right now, which, of course, is the AI monster in the room. And I know you've written about Treebeard's razor with regard to AI art and writing. Can you explain to us, what is Treebeard's razor and what does it tell us about the value or lack thereof of AI produced art?
Well, so I started with a quote from Tolkien. I'm paraphrasing now because I don't have it right in front of me, but it's when the hobbits are getting really irritated with the Ents taking forever because old Entish takes a long time to say anything. And Treebeard tells them, you know, we Ents don't believe it's worth saying anything unless it's worth taking a long time to say. And so one of the things that AI was used to sell, both for art and writing, was basically as a time saver. Think of all this time you can save by, instead of saying something yourself through writing, for example, or through artwork, you can just put a prompt into the machine and have it say it. And so I mostly use Treebeard's razor as basically a hook to draw people in. And there were a lot of other concepts I wanted to go over, but one of the biggest ones was how offensive it is to take up people's time by acting like you have something to say to them, right? But then not having anything to say, because if you have AI write something for you or produce an artwork or a movie or whatever and put it in front of people, it means you really didn't have anything to tell them at all, but you took up their time anyways. And if you had something to tell them, then you still couldn't have had AI because you would have had to just say it, right? So if you have something you want to tell people through writing, write it. If there's a visual imagery you want to share with people, paint it or photograph it and say it to them that way. But if you have so little to say that you could just put a prompt into AI, then just don't take up people's time with it at all. So I felt like that was something that hadn't gotten enough attention, of how offensive it was to be fed AI content by anyone. Something else I wanted to go over too in that essay that I covered was that people have this feeling that if they get fooled by something, they have to accept it, right? Because in the modern world, I think we especially, again, I think we're kind of shallow because of materialism. We think there's just the material world and nothing deeper. So we think, well, if on the surface it looks like that, then we have to just accept that that's actually what it is. And you see this in everything. I mean, even something like nutrition, right? Like from the standpoint of conventional nutrition, they'll never go over a breakdown. Sorry, there's one of my cats pestering me. They'll never go over a breakdown of how that product got there. Like from conventional nutrition, they'll just treat beef like it's all the same thing, whether the cow was eating grain in a feedlot or out on a pasture. So it's just everywhere, this idea that just what you see on the surface is all that's there. So because of that, when people, if they get fooled by something, if they read an article and they think it was AI, they now feel like, or they think it was real, they feel like they now have to appreciate it. And it would be hypocritical of them if after they found out the truth about it to change their opinion. And something I wanted to emphasize is that the truth actually does make a difference. So if you thought one way about something before you knew the truth about it, and then you learn the truth about it, it's perfectly acceptable to change your opinion about it. So one of the devices I used for trying to illustrate this point was giving an example of a mother who gets a call from her son, and she's happy to finally get a call from her son because he generally doesn't call. And, you know, he makes a point of actually calling and talking with her. And then later on, she finds out he was just using an AI program, that it would be appropriate and right of her. And this, I think people could understand to be offended when initially she'd been happy about her son calling, because now she understands the truth about it. So I just wanted to give people confidence with that, that if they do see something, whether in visual art or writing, and they think it's AI and they think it's great, which generally you're not going to, because it still kind of sucks and it might continue to because of the way it averages everything together. But still, even if that happens, to go ahead and change your opinion afterwards, because now you found out something new about it.
Very interesting and thought-provoking. So what is the best way for people to support and follow your work?
From the standpoint of supporting my work, there's a couple things people could do that are kind of cool. One is I do make it available for anyone when they're doing like blogs or editorials to go ahead and use it as an illustration. I do just ask that they give me a hyperlink, you know, just credit it as that I'm the one who did it and put in a hyperlink. So that I really appreciate it when people do that, because it gets it in front of more people. Other people, like during COVID, actually would get some of the prints of my artwork if they had businesses and put it up. I mean, obviously, you'd have to be very comfortable with that, and I wouldn't want anyone to do it unless it felt sincere and authentic to them. And then I sell prints and things like that, and all of that helps when people do get any of that, including the non-political work. Like maybe somebody doesn't want to put up my political work in their living room, but they want to support it. They could always get a print or a painting of something that's not political.
Excellent. I think we'll leave this conversation here for today. I'm sure there's much more we can and should discuss, but hopefully in the future. Jordan Henderson, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
There he goes, ladies and gentlemen. That's Jordan Henderson. Once again, yes, please do go to jordanhendersonfineart.com if you want to know more about his work or how to support him. Or you can, of course, go to anthonyfrieda.com to find out more about Anthony and his work, or why not both? Of course, the links to all of that will be in the show notes for today's episode, but I will not belabor the point. Talking about visual art is like dancing about architecture. So if you have been listening to the audio version of this podcast, I would highly suggest this is one of those podcasts you might want to go see the video version of, or at the very least, go and check out the websites of the artists mentioned today so you can actually see the work that we were talking about. And I think we will leave things there for today. You do not need to hear me go on and on about how important visual art is in terms of just spreading awareness. But anyway, you can see the effect that it can have on people and the effect that it has in shaping and changing people's awareness, as we have seen with the visual artists that we talked to today. I am sure there are plenty of other artists that are working out there who have had similar effects on people around the world in shaping, helping to shape their thoughts and opinions and positions when it comes to these important matters and trying to expand the consciousness of the viewing public. So I'd be very interested to hear about your suggestions. Who else do you think is doing good resistance art that should be featured in a podcast like this one? If you are a Corbett Report member, you can, of course, go to corbettreport.com/resistanceart. To leave your suggestion in the comment section there. And I'm looking forward to hearing your feedback about this and about visual art and its use in helping to unlock minds generally. But I think we're going to leave today's exploration there. So that's going to do it for today. I am James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, thanking you for investing your mind time in today's episode, and looking forward to talking to you again in the near future. The Corbett Report is 100% listener-supported. Join the Corbett Report community to become a member and log into CorbettReport.com to read the subscriber newsletter featuring my weekly editorial, recommended reading and viewing, discounts on Corbett Report merchandise, and once a month, a subscriber exclusive video. Sign up today at CorbettReport.com/members and help support this independent media.